to our public service program of the week, May Brussels and Dialogue Conspiracy. Take it away, May.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy featuring research specialist May Brussels.
That's the one you forgot to push last week. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, by golly.
Sorry.
Don't tune out yet.
Such a long, 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 long time before the dawn.
Hello for Dialogue Conspiracy. I'm a little bit exhausted. I watched some of Robert Haldeman this afternoon on the television and fell asleep. He puts me to sleep. I have a mental block against listening to these people get up and use every espionage trick to get out of getting to the facts. I don't expect to hear any facts from most of the people on the stand. They are using every face-saving device that's created by the intelligence agencies before they ever start an operation. The system to protect itself is built into the operation, the anticipation, the event they get caught. And watching the hearings is very frustrating because the committee, the Senate members are not equipped to investigate an operation like this. And they give the appearance of wanting to find out what happened at the Watergate Hotel, just like a doctor may give the appearance of wanting to make a diagnosis about a patient coming in, but hasn't had the training or the ability or seen a disease like that before. These men sit up there, and when they just get close to truth, there's a lot of diversions to get away from what is actually taking place, and this is going to be really an obstacle course and frustration to just watch the parade of people get up on the screen and tell their story. I knew that Haldeman would have this long speech, and among other things, I did hear him say that he didn't know what Donald Segretti was used for. Here's a man that spent between $40,000 and $90,000 that they're admitting, and was responsible, say, with the plumbers for making Senator Muskie not be able to win the New Hampshire primaries and give up the chance of running for president, and they can, you know, write it off. Well, I don't know what he was doing. Everything he did, I thought was legal. So therefore, I'm not responsible for him. The re-election committee can hire the man, but they don't know what he's doing. Well, everything that Richard Nixon did in his career, not everything he did was legal, but a lot of the things that he did were legal, but they hurt other people and caused him to win elections, like writing letters about his opponents, Mr. Voorhees or Helen Douglas, sending stationery out and saying they're communists. And then when the election is over, saying, well, I didn't know they weren't communists. There's no law in Washington. You can't write a law and say that you can't call an opponent a name, you know, and then control that factor because they come up with another name. The man has a million tricks. He's been using them ever since he started running for the House of Representatives. And the people around him are known for dirty tricks. His campaigns are known for dirty tricks. And they can say, well, I gave the money and I gave the approval. And I gave the orders, even from the White House down. But I don't know what they were doing. An example of one of the tricks they don't want to talk about came up this week when John Ehrlichman was on the stand, and they were talking about the White House plumbers. And the subject came out, well, what was that other mission? What did the plumbers do? They were supposed to be finding the leak in the salt talks, and the National Security Council had a leak, or the India-Pakistan agreements. There was a leak coming out from the National Security Council about their various meetings, memos were being leaked. Well, that was the cover story for hiring the plumbers in the White House, which was an attack group, was the leaks. They weren't working on leaks. And when they came to one subject this last week where they said, what is that paragraph? What was one of their missions? And John Ehrlichman couldn't say because it involved national security. And they said, what other examples of wiretapping and like the Ellsberg break-in and what other things did the plumbers do? They were set up with an office down the basement with a scrambler that connected to every intelligence agency in the United States, but they couldn't say what the plumbers did. Well, the reason they don't want to tell on the television screen, it's perfectly obvious. It's embarrassing. And while it's printed in the newspaper what the plumbers were doing, it doesn't reach very many people because it's in the underground press. But there's an article in the L.A. Star written by Don Fried, who helped co-author Executive Action. And he has a section here about what E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy and Frank Sturgis were doing. It says, even more dramatic than the fact that Hunt and Liddy and Frank Sturgis were in Mexico in 1971 was part of their Executive Action to assassinate the president of Panama. This was being organized under Operation Intercept, and it had to do with narcotics. Now, remember, the cover story for this group, Operation Intercept, was to stop the flow of narcotics into the United States from Mexico, which I said was their cover story. Well, Don Fried's Operation Intercept had to do with narcotics, but not the kind of narcotics you think about, because narcotics, in this case, was coming in through Panama, and the president of Panama was not cooperating in the United States. And I understand it wasn't in this article that Hunt and McCord and the whole gang were very much into heavy drug traffic in cocaine from Latin America. It's been rumored and being checked out coming into this country. Not in stopping it, but in it trafficked through, and they were part of the Latin American operation, as I understand. Well, Operation Intercept was to assassinate the president of Panama because he wasn't cooperating with the drug problem, which could be interpreted either he's not supplying enough or he's shipping it into the country. But this is one of the areas that they wanted to meet Panama head-on. The United States, the article says, was to be denounced in Panama for refusing to give up the Panama Canal and for its imperialism and neocolonialism. And it was a humiliating experience for the United States last year in Panama. But the abortive assassination plot was called up. Well, Hunt and Sturgis were involved in killing the president of Guatemala in the late 50s. He was driving down the street in a motorcade, and a so-called leftist communist shot Mr. Gutzman. That was in 1954. And then that person was killed, and they said the lone assassin shot him. Well, that lone assassin was the dry run for the Kennedy assassination. So the little secret mission of the plumbers was to kill the president of Panama in 1971. Not only would that make the government of Panama angry, but it would reaffirm the role of the White House and the National Security Council to effect continuous political assassinations all over the world. And Hunt and Liddy were part of that operation, and so were all the members of the White House for many years, the intelligence agents. I started to see the names running through various operations and made just a brief diagram of them, you know, last evening to see how much I read I can put into these little charts of where these particular agents work together. Because Alan Dulles and Hunt and Sturgis were in on the assassination of the president of Guatemala, Mr. Gutzman. And then I got a hold of Richard Nixon's book, which I've read parts of it on the radio show before. And I picked it up again to check off the place where Mr. Cushman of the CIA, who figures in the Watergate affair, and Mr. Walters were down with him in Caracas. And that, if any of you who haven't read MI6 Crisis, or you read it a long time ago, get it and read it again. Get the paperback or the hardbound. I think the hardbound's hard to get, but you get the paperback. And it's really, it's mind-blowing, the Richard Nixon account of his Latin American trip, which he calls his fourth crisis. And that's the one where he's briefed by the CIA and sent down to these different countries. And the so-called communists threw rocks at him, and his two little girls were at home listening to a radio telephone in their house. And they heard about the riots in Lima, Peru. And Tricia comes home from school and says, what are they doing to Daddy and Mommy in South America? And the staging of those riots was done for votes at home and for political effect. And it was a very controlled trip by the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council. And they weren't so suspect of ripping off countries at the time that he wrote this. So it's very revealing, because today he'd be more careful, I'm sure, in what he would write about those events. He goes into a riot in front of the university in Peru one day, and there were demonstrations at various places. But they had advance warning there were going to be the demonstrations. And so he called in Bob Cushman of the CIA. That's the same Bob Cushman that supplied the wigs and speaking devices and mouth speaking to alter conversations and the way dialect, you know, that a person uses, they put something into their mouth. It's a gas. And the safe houses and the CIA aliases and the passports. The same Cushman that provided all this for the Chappaquiddick excursions or the Dita Beard or the Ellsberg. He was down in Latin America with Richard Nixon and at the time of the riots. And one day they had a lot of press coverage, and Nixon said, I asked Bob Cushman to give me a rundown on the reaction at the San Marcos University. And he replied that all the reports were favorable, except that two of their aides, one of them, his name is Rub Bottom and Birnbaum, expressed concern that maybe the Peruvian government was embarrassed. And Nixon says, I blew my stack. I told Cushman to have them come to my room immediately. And they're dressing for a state dinner. And they came in half-dressed, and I ripped into them and said, you know, why are you feeling sorry for Peru? What about me? And he really told them hell. And after that, he was told that he got messages, your job was well done, and Eisenhower lied to him. Dear Dick, you did a wonderful job of keeping your calm against those radical agitators down there. And his account of the briefing, how Eisenhower tells them to go and that they're voting is a little uncertain. In 1958, the chances of picking up Republican seats in the Congress and how they staged this little trip down to Latin America. Nixon gives a slur down there. He said it's something he didn't really want to do when he was told that he should go as a vice president. He said, I thought it'd be relatively unimportant and not interesting as an assignment. But he went to the CIA and got his briefings, and evidently they cooked up these riots and provocateurs to make him the hero, the same way that Spiro Agnew was built up with the provocateurs and the riots after the Martin Luther King murder. The intelligence agencies have been working as a synchronized team through this whole Cold War. And I hope that enough of these people's names come out through all these operations that it will become an intelligent a pattern that can be actually just charted and diagrammed based upon many books. I'm sure my library has these names running through it in different events that took place, but I don't have all these names indexed. But I made a diagram when Lee Harvey Oswald was in Soviet Union. He was following the vapor trails for the U-2 flight, and that was part of his job. And recently it's come out that James McCord was working in the Soviet Union as an agent the same time Oswald was there, and then he was in England, and he was an interrogator identifying Soviet intelligence agents and who questioned the airmen. He was very much up on all the behind scenes in the Soviet Union at the time Oswald was there. And E. Howard Hunt was engaged in the 50s on the U-2 spy plane project. So that while Oswald was over in Japan at the Tsugi Air Base with the U-2 flights, Howard Hunt was with the U-2, and so was James McCord and Alan Dulles and Lee Harvey Oswald. So you have five people. The National Archives has locked up papers on Oswald's access to the U-2 flight. But these operatives that are in the Watergate, except for Lee Harvey Oswald, who was murdered as part of his assignment as a patsy, these other names appear, like McCord and Hunt, involved with the U-2 incident. You know, it was McCord who spoke up to Judge Sirica because he was afraid that the intelligence agencies were becoming like a Gestapo or a police state, and that's one of the reasons he started to talk, because he saw the Nazification of this country taking place. And his testimony before Judge Sirica fits in with a statement by Andrew Tully this week. Andrew Tully is a friend of J. Edgar Hoover's, and Hoover gave him a lot of papers and files before he died. They were only to be revealed in the event that they were historically valuable. And Tully had an interview last week in a syndicated column about J. Edgar Hoover's death. And what he said was that J. Edgar Hoover was afraid that Richard Nixon would get caught up with the CIA as it was formed. And this is the quotation, by God, he, Mr. Nixon, has some former CIA men working for him that I'd kick out of my office. Someday that bunch will serve him a fine mess. This is what Tully wrote, and the article was printed in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And J. Edgar Hoover, this is Interesting point. J. Edgar Hoover said, I put the kibosh on those Jaspers who want to get rid of me. I saw the president a couple of months ago. This was in January 72. And we agreed I should stay on to that job because the president asked my thoughts about my retirement. And I said none because I told him he needed me around to protect him from the people around him. Now, that's an interesting comment because I believe that J. Edgar Hoover was murdered. And I believe that Nixon, the part of the plans after the election or the nomination in November, between the nomination election, was to murder Richard Nixon. And this piece of information fits in with a lot of documentation that I'm saying on why J. Edgar Hoover was murdered and on the assassination plans for Richard Nixon. So this was an interesting quotation from the Philadelphia paper. I didn't see it out here, but it came by way of the Washington Post. That J. Edgar Hoover said, I have to stay on to protect him from the people around him. Now, the excuse for the White House interintelligence agency that would do the surreptitious entry and the no-knock and the wiretap the telephones and bug and open mail, the most flimsy excuses formed this organization. That J. Edgar Hoover said, take away our civil rights. Now, the people behind the interagency claim that Hoover was senile, couldn't handle the agency, that they had to take logs away from him. The logs that he had would have cost Nixon the election if he had blackmailed Nixon and Agnew. I can't imagine if that agency were really necessary or important, why J. Edgar Hoover would have objected to it. They claim he would have lost his autonomy or his control of the FBI. But if the purpose is to take over the FBI, it's true that he would lose his power there. Hoover was not squeamish about the Kennedy assassinations. He played a major part in them. He played a major role in the killing of 28 Black Panthers. He just didn't like the martial law plan, and I don't think he liked the idea that George Wallace would be shot. Wallace was killed just within a couple of days after Hoover was buried. And one thing came right on top of the other in synchronized fashion. Mr. Hunt, Howard Hunt, has suffered a stroke, an apparent stroke, which isn't played up much in the press. He's not in the hospital. His legs are partially paralyzed. He was moved from the prison in Washington, D.C. to Danbury, Connecticut. The account about the stroke is believed that he got it when a cellmate in the District of Columbia jail had a fight with him. And since that time, he's been upset, and he said it was very traumatic, and he was transferred to another jail. His physical condition is deteriorating physically and psychologically, and he claims he won't last 2 years in prison. Well, they say that Howard Hunt looks like an old man, wet with perspiration and in bad shape. This kind of reminds me of Charles Watson, who did all the killings in the Manson murder case that Manson's blamed for when he wasn't in the homes. Charles Watson, who represents the military intelligence group from Texas, came into a fetal position into a hospital and rolled up, and he was sweating and in bad shape and couldn't stand trial with Charles Manson. And then after Manson got a guilty conviction, old Watson, it turned out, was faking, and the nurses said he was faking. He pulled himself out of it and stood a trial, and I'm sure that someday he'll get paroled and Manson won't, because his name isn't even associated with the five murders at the home of Sharon Tate and Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca. So it's hard to tell whether Howard Hunt has a real sickness in prison or whether he's pulling a Charlie Watson. He knows all the tricks they do. So it isn't hard to guess that, you know, that he's using one of those. He could be very sick, or he could be faking it. He says he has ulcers and high blood pressure, and he's having a hard time. Now, the night before he testified at the grand jury, that's where he gave out the evidence about Charles Colson being in the White House with Nixon the night that Wallace was shot and being told to go to Arthur Bramer's apartment. That night he was beat up, and maybe he did have a concussion. The cell was open, and somebody was put in there with him. And now he's having a hard time. He's not allowed to have a typewriter. And he was setting a publishing record of 17 books that were supposed to go in the bookstore at one time. He's churned out 17 books, but he has no more typewriter, and he's in bad shape. So Howard Hunt's illness, his wife has been murdered, and his illness could be a true sickness, and he is deteriorating, or he's faking it so that, you know, if he, like one of the members of the mafia, that DiCarlo got out because he didn't have long to live, and he's floating around here apparently in pretty good health, and he got executive clemency or pardon, and the president let him out at Christmas. And if Howard Hunt says, I only have 2 years to live, maybe he'll be out. But right now, he's not having such a good time in prison. I don't feel sorry for him, but he's not having such a good time. The Lyndon Johnson Library is falling down. We did a show on that a while back. There were a lot of cartoons about it, holding the books that he valued so much. The library cost $18 million, and the marble is coming down. It's going to cost $2 million to go into that front marble and find out what's crumbling. But there's a little bit of, maybe I have a perverted sense of humor, but there's so many lies in that building, so much history be rewritten, that I don't think the walls can handle it anymore. So the travertine marble, the exterior, is crumbling. And that'll take $2 million to fix the front, but what are they going to do with the inside? It's hard to know. I have a lot of different articles that I brought in today on... one of them is on spying, because the Civil Rights Committee in New York City recommended legislation to prohibit military surveillance of civilian political activities and dossiers and data banks, and to prohibit spying in general. And I thought that was interesting because Monterey is about to have its televised streets. There's a suggestion for television monitoring camera in downtown Monterey, and the budget allows $10,000 for video monitoring system in the downtown area. Some councilmen objected. Some felt it was like 1984 Big Brother. Others thought it was depersonalized and gave bad vibes. And then the mayor, Peter J. Coniglio of Monterey, said he had doubts about the effectiveness. And he said, I'd rather see another man down there, but he'd be willing to give the camera a try. You see, nobody has the courage to speak up. Everyone has their doubts. Everyone knows it's wrong. Getting bad vibes, but I'll give it a try. Why people not speak up, or why don't they have the vision to see that once you set the precedent, something's going to happen? All the men, you know, who opposed it didn't oppose it hard enough. So evidently there's going to be a try at this camera in Monterey, and which is... while they're talking about barring spying on civilians, it's justified for another purpose. Like, the same system can say, well, we're not spying on civilians. We're protecting your store against robbery so that you don't have military control of the town. But what do you do in a situation like this? Ronald Reagan has proposed a new cabinet, which he has a task force working on. When he assigns a task force, that means it's being written up for this polished state. And that task force, remember, we talked about that on one program, included the military, the law enforcement, the police departments, the youth authorities, the California Criminal Justice Department, Highway Patrol. Well, if a policeman is to check out if there's a robbery, and the military is in on it too, and you're using the same camera, why isn't it military surveillance? How do you draw the line between what is military surveillance of people moving and people patterns, or protecting you from being robbed on the street? If they're all going to go under one office, there is no separation. So that to fight crime in the streets, you're inviting the military to take over the data banks, and then they become one. So it's such a technicality to ask the surveillance of the military in when the civilians are joining with the military to, in quotes, protect us. There was one good sign last week. The House Appropriations Committee had $1.5 million for special projects that they always give President Nixon, and they refused to give it. This time there was a budget of $4.8 billion, and on it was $1.5 million for a certain amount of given projects. And they asked the Office of Management Budget to provide a listing of the individual vouchers and expenditures that were used before to see whether they're financing Hunt and Liddy and these kidnappings and sabotage systems and call girls. An Office of Management Budget couldn't turn over the list. They declined to give the information. So Representative Edward Roybal asked Fred Malik for the names of persons who received money under this special project. And Malik gave a list of the people he hired from July 1st, 72. But he didn't have any of the names of the convicted Watergate burglars. It didn't have their assignments. It just said who was hired, and there was no way of knowing what these special projects were. So they asked at the hearing, was Mr. Hunt paid out of this fund for special projects? The burglars, the so-called burglars, E. Howard Hunt, was convicted in the Watergate case. And Fred Malik said he couldn't answer that question without checking into the records. Well, I'm sure if they paid him, they would know one way or the other. All of these espionage operators that worked in the Watergate and into this spy team are tied into the Office of Management Budget, which I've saying for a long time should be dismantled, and the decisions of domestic matters be put with congressional committees, not with military committees, because the Office of Management Budget is made up of Roy Ash and Linton Industries that overthrew the Greek, put in the Greek military junta. And people who are in favor of fascism or installing fascism in another country certainly must think it's good enough for us. So they use, and spying and sabotaging is the way you get in a police state. But they will not answer if Howard Hunt was employed by them at the time he was a consultant in the White House. He was there from June 6, 1971 to April 1st, 1972. So Congress said, well, if you don't tell us if Hunt and Liddy worked for you, if we weren't paying for their operations and the Republican offices, CREEP wasn't paying for it, Congress isn't going to pay for it. So they cut off $1.5 million for the special projects. The problem is that the intelligence agencies can just take it out of the Treasury Department. Who's to know? They can write a check or give the consecutive $100 bill. So if they want the $1.5 million, they can get any number of ways. Roy Ash has a cost overrun of billions into his submarines. He can add $1.5 million to the cost overruns, and that would pay for the men inside the White House. Many men, secret agents, and Fred LaRue and a whole team of them, worked in the White House with no salary, supposedly no salary. And they were liaisons from the Justice Department, the White House, and in with, you know, hiring provocateurs and very much a part of the national scene, but accountable to nobody, no paycheck or anything to stop them. Well, there was a lot of talk when Herbert Kalmbach was on and Anthony Lasowitz about money that went to the Wallace campaign, and I was wondering why the Wallace people didn't speak up. But this week, State Attorney General Bill Baxley asked Archibald Cox to discuss the charges that funds from the Nixon campaign it were funneled against George Wallace. Now, I'm sure that some of this would be that killer money if they could trace all of the money. They would find a good deal of the missing money, unaccounted for money, large amounts passed in that hotel, passed at secret meeting places, went in the Wallace campaign to defeat Wallace. Well, the one thing that really defeated him was shooting him, and the Southern strategy just culminated at that point. Because there's so much evidence that that was a conspiracy to shoot George Wallace, it's very important to look for where the money's coming from. So finally, the Wallace people from Alabama have asked to meet with Mr. Cox based upon the information that Kalmbach had of at least $400,000 coming from one New York bank. And there was more than money coming from Maryland and a lot of banks. But this is the start that they want to know where that $400,000 went, because what if it didn't go into a senator's name, a member of the House of Representatives? What if it went into Bremer's bank account? I'm sure some of that money wouldn't be listed right now in Bremer's account, but if the people they were supposed to give it to, this $400,000 defeat Wallace, didn't receive it and haven't paid taxes on it and haven't used it, then that'll open up another can of worms, which they're asking for now to see who allegedly received the $400,000. They're trying Washington now. The committee is trying to curb the CIA powers, and they're trying to get new election laws. And these things are interesting. They're a step forward, but they make me wonder. I'm so skeptical of these laws and the way they're handled, because once again, the people writing the laws are either part of the system or stupid. I can't decide which. But there are so many loopholes left. Because this week the Senate voted for stiff criminal penalties for using campaign contributions to pay the legal expenses of defendants, such as in the Watergate case. And they want violations of up to 10 years in jail or $25 fine if people subvert the electoral process the way they did before. One lone man, Senator Metcalf of Montana, voted against changing the funding of the campaigns, but all the rest voted for it. But one of the amendments they wanted to do is to bar cash contributions of more than $50 to candidates for office and limit $100 on cash contributions. This is one alternative. One was 50, one was 100, because they didn't want any floating money around it. And there, if you gave over 50, you had to do it in check or written form so it could be checked. No more collecting of cash. There's a limit, you know, to what you can give, and a $3,000 limit on what you can give to any particular candidate. And they're working on these reforms, which are interesting, but they don't solve several other basic problems. When you get men that are still part of the police state, like Spiro Agnew or Ronald Reagan, they are incumbents in office, military trained. Reagan's Air Force, retired Air Force intelligence, hoping to become president of the United States. So he has a budget of how much he can spend on running for president or being the political limelight until they get rid of Nixon and then coming into prominence. How much can he spend? Well, he doesn't need the cash because he uses Army airplanes. He has his own private plane. His excuse for the plane is that he won't get hijacked. But it also gives him a lot of mileage because for political reasons he can use the plane. So somebody can create a political dinner in Los Angeles or up at Eureka, back at Sacramento or San Luis Obispo, San Jose. And he can be flying all over the state, which is thousands of dollars of money that another person running against him needs, like Mr. Waldie wants to run for governor. And I read that he's walking up and down the state of California, you know, on a foot thing, trying to meet people. But Ronald Reagan can take his airplane and go up and down this state and meet many more people, pick up a microphone as the governor and justify his programs and control the reporting of them and get on radio stations. So the same thing goes with Spiro Agnew. He's the vice president. So his obligations as vice president are to make these trips to all these military dictatorships and be met there and news coverage, television coverage. And how does somebody running against these men in another election get the opportunity to equal them in exposure? Because exposure is what you're talking about. If you're selling bars of soap or a product, a table wax on television, if one person can sell it, certain wax like Pride for 2 years almost every night and get some attention and bring out these beautiful tables and show them shine, and then somebody else is trying to sell the product, but they don't get any television time except one night before the campaign or a small budget. How can you compete with the incumbent? The money isn't the problem entirely in getting a fair election. The amount of exposure that they pull automatically then assures them, because if you limit the funding of the opponent, he can't equal your exposure in any way. I think who gives the money, the list should be published so that we know whether our laws for gasoline shortages or ecology or clean air or the polluted rivers, we should know if those are being put aside because certain people have given to the campaigns. But it seems to me that rearranging, I think you need a law on campaign spending. Something was terrible in the last election, but there still has to be some control of the exposure of the incumbent, so that the person running against him gets a fair shake. And I don't know how that's done. Senator Stennis is still recuperating at Walter Reed Hospital from the assassination attempt, which the newspaper describes as a robbery. And he's trying to curb the CIA powers. Well, there's a little bit of irony in there, because I think the CIA shot Stennis last year. He was opposing the appointment of Roy Ash. He wanted Roy Ash and Fred Malik to be before the Senate for confirmation hearings. He was opposing the war policy and the escalation of war in Cambodia. Stennis was doing things against the desires of the existing administration, and he was shot and almost killed. So now he's recuperating from what the paper says is a robbery, which I think was a determined effort to get rid of Senator Stennis. And he can't go into the inquiry into the phony charges, those men. That case has been silenced up, and it's very secretive, and you can't go into who the men were that really shot him, were they hired killers, which it seems they were. And all the time he's talking about despicable atrocities of the CIA. In this country, he probably was the victim of one like Wallace, and yet they can't see themselves as relating to the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, the Senate is still having hearings on the appointment of William Colby to head the intelligence agency. And one of the most disgusting things I've heard is that even though they are hearing and people are protesting, the Senate intends to appoint him the head of the CIA. And I asked last week for people to write to members of the Senate and object to this appointment. Mr. Colby has been accused of lawlessness and violation of fundamental norms and locking up. There's a Catholic priest, a Roman priest by the name of Drinnett, who said the Phoenix program that Mr. Colby headed has brought about the virtual dictatorship of President Thieu, and that the United States is responsible. And he was one of the witnesses into the brutality and the torture and injustices that swept South Vietnam. And he is going to be the head of our CIA. And the one defendant for Colby said, well, you can't take into action what happened. He's not responsible for it. Just because that happened while he was in the CIA and it was his program, you're certainly not going to make him responsible. So Senator Symington said, why, the CIA has gone long beyond its charter for what it's supposed to do in the continental United States, but I don't want to take it out on an individual. Well, that individual has exemplifies tortures, harassment, fake elections in Vietnam, spreading terror in the community. Why do we need him in this country? Why doesn't he just stay in the military and not control a nation that already isn't completely infiltrated by the CIA? Speaking of bugging, I had one other article. Besides the streets of Monterey being bugged, the U.S. District Courts have warned up in San Francisco, the judges have warned that there's installation of closed-circuit television monitoring of court areas, which, again, is for us, our protection. It's for security purposes. But there's a watch-and-hear system. So if you go to any courts up in San Francisco and attend the trial, like Rochelle McGee, San Quentin 6, there's a whole bunch of trials that will be taking place. The courtrooms for now are bugged. They said it's a security tool. It's a useful tool for security. We are being so protected against the enemy, by the enemy. Everything is justified as security. You'll be secure because they can listen to conversations, see if you're in danger. But if you're watching a trial, you're with somebody, you can't talk about the judge, you can't talk about the defendant or the prosecution. Things where you want to compare notes, you have to leave the courtroom because everything is being picked up on these bugs. And there's monitoring, they warn on the 17th floor, the 19th floor, the 20th floor. And everything is visually and audibly taken down. There are 51 listening devices in San Francisco in the courthouse, and 41 of them are areas only used by marshals escorting the prisoners to and from the courts. And 10 are the visiting places open to the visitors. But those 10 are strategically placed, I'm sure, by the entrance and the benches and the water fountains, the telephone booth, to pick up any conversation, and it controls the population. These things are diabolical and are a purpose of control, and you can pick up opponents to particular laws that come down or acts that come down by their conversation, their outrage at trials. You know where their head is at. You know why they're there to visit the prisoner or attend a trial. These are all methods of oppression, and they keep becoming fact. And while they're taking place, people don't realize that they're part of a general conspiratorial relationship to past political assassinations and methods of controlling population. As the population gets wise to the oppression and begins to talk and compare notes, the best way you can control them is to bug them, then follow these people, follow them home, harass them, give them tickets for attending trials. This happens all the time, catching them for bad traffic fines that weren't paid. When you go to visit a trial, you keep your records clean, and now you can't talk in the halls or compare notes. You have to go out of the building. If you go out of the building, you do for another skin search and purse search, and you can't get back in. So you're caught. You either have to keep silent till you get home. And remember that this is an internal domestic war going on. Or speak up to your partner, whoever you're with, watching the trial, and take the risks. So the San Francisco courthouses are bugged. Mr. Art Buchwald had comments in the paper this last week, which he always writes comic things, legends in our time, he called this particular article. I'm not going to read all the points he made, but I thought I'd share a few of them with you, because the Watergate news is coming in so fast and heavy that the impact of what is taking place is hard. It's hard to comprehend. It's hard for me, and I've been following it for 1 year closely, so that all the names ring a bell and I see the interweaving of what each one had said or didn't say, and it's a pattern that I work hard to keep up with. But the little details sometimes are lost in the broad implications of what is Watergate going to mean a few years from now when you talk about it. And Buchwald had a few comments which kind of summarize what was happening there. I'll read you a few of these. One of them was, he said, it cost American Airlines $100,000 to fly Herbert Kalmbach from New York to Washington. That was the payoff money he was going to give particular people who'd been arrested, blackmail money. He said, John Mitchell, who told the country to judge us by what we do, not what we say, can't remember what he did. That's a quotation when the Black Caucus met with John Mitchell about a year and a half ago on certain problems in this country and wanted to know how the Justice Department was going to treat these situations that were very important. And he said, don't listen to what I say, watch what I do. And Buchwald says, Mitchell told the country, judge what we do, but now he can't remember what he did. He's forgotten all that. He went on to say, no one approved of G. Gordon Liddy's plan to break into the Democratic headquarters. He did it on his own against the protests of everyone in the White House and the Committee for the Reelection of President, if you would believe that. The same way, he says, when people commit a burglary for a political party, their lawyer's fee should be paid in cash and their families be taken care of for humanitarian reasons. He said the way to get back at someone who steals papers from the Pentagon is to raid his psychiatrist's office. Then no one talked to the President of the United States from June 17, 1972 until March 22, 1973 about his own political campaign. These are the things they're trying to ask us, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell stands to believe. He said it takes $20 million to get an incumbent president nominated by his own party for a second term. It took $60 million to get him elected and $20 million secret money, but $20 just to get the nomination. The only person in the Watergate affair who doesn't have a good lawyer is the President of the United States. Remember John Dean, John Mitchell, Mr. Moore, Mr. Haldeman, the whole team, no one told him anything. Herbert Kalmbach, his personal lawyer, handles his financial world, nothing. The only person, if you would believe it, in Watergate affair who doesn't have a good lawyer is the President. If you commit a crime involving the administration, the first thing you ask for is immunity. See, actually, we're getting the whole espionage operation and what Buchwald takes as a tongue-in-cheek, but are facts. He relates them as facts. John Ehrlichman's favorite hobby was recording the conversations of people who came to his office. John Dean was running the White House alone for the past year. If you believe it, Nixon was never told anything about his political campaign. Dean was running the White House. There was an attorney to speak to the president that anyone was in trouble. The CIA does not launder money in Mexico. They told you they didn't, so they don't. L. Patrick Gray might be the head of the FBI if he only knew enough not to burn state's evidence, if he just put it in a safe. The mentality of the FBI, you know, the director burning it, is so important. If Charles Colson didn't like you, you could expect an audit by the Internal Revenue. The White House, he said, did not earn interest in the $350,000 kept in Haldeman's safe. They kept this cash, and he's making a slur because it wasn't put in the bank. If the president had known what was going on in the Watergate, according to John Mitchell, he would have taken action, and he would have lost the election. So here you have a democratic society and a process that's supposed to be working in an orderly manner, and the former attorney general telling you that if we gave you all the evidence, he wouldn't have won the election. If the president hadn't maintained three White Houses, he probably would have found out about the Watergate. He traveled around so much that he didn't know what was happening. And if you read the paper today, he spent $10 million, not $1 million on his homes, because he was fixing up that house at Coy Bay and the safe house that Julie Eisenhower rents from Bebe Rebozo, where I'm sure they're having their strategy meeting since the Watergate affair. $10 million of security for Richard Nixon. Well, our time is up. I'll see you next week. Keep up with the television hearings and save your articles, and we'll sit back someday and we'll talk about all this when it quiets down, if it ever does.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy, featuring research specialist Mae Brussel. A peace to be